Quick, what fish was named for a West Indian clergyman? It's a simple trivia question, but the answer sent author Philip Dodd on a quest that crossed oceans and spanned continents. What is the mystery fish? The humble guppy. Dodd's book is called The Reverend Guppy's Aquarium, from Joseph P. Frisbee to Roy Jacuzzi, How Everyday Items Were Named for Extraordinary People. And Philip Dodd is in our studios in London. Hello there.
Hello, Andrea.
So let's start with the opening scene here. You're at home. You're watching TV. The show is called University Challenge. It's a quiz show like Jeopardy here, I guess. And that faded question stumps everyone.
That's right. And the reason it really caught my attention was that right next to the sofa, about 2 feet to my left, was our tank, a fish full of guppies. And I just had a little eureka moment that I looked at it and I thought, I never, ever knew they were named after a human being. It had never crossed my mind. And I started checking out this Robert Letchmere guppy, and I got intrigued into his life, and then that led me to think, well, here's something I can pursue, because there are little corners of human life that usually through fate or some kind of serendipity, these people have been immortalized in our language.
Let's start with the jacuzzi. You actually tracked down its inventor, Roy Jacuzzi.
Roy is alive and well, bubbling with ideas still. He's a great guy. He lives out in California, and what I loved about meeting Roy was finding out how important family tradition was. He comes from this family of Italian immigrants who came through Ellis Island in the 1900s. There were 7 brothers and 6 sisters. And they were imaginative, inventive people, very good with their hands. And they eventually ended up in California, where they started developing pumps for, you know, work in the fruit farms there. They also were early aeroplane builders. In fact, they built a plane, this is sort of 1910s, called the Jacuzzi J7, which was one of the world's first passenger planes. And Roy is third generation. He came out of college in the mid-60s in California. He'd been studying design and engineering. And he looked at one of the products the family had developed, which was the only way I can really describe it is like a little outboard motor that you would put in your bath to swirl the waters in a domestic bath round. And Roy looked at that, and I think he just felt, you know, the time and place, mid-60s in California, that it could be a whole lot more fun. And he developed those, you know, those swivel jets that you get in the side of a jacuzzi. That's really his specific invention. Put that together, and in a funny way, I think he really invented a lifestyle.
One of the things that's so wonderful about this book is that it's not just a compilation of trivia. You know, this was named after this guy and the sandwich and this and that. But you really dig into the lives of these people. You travel to their homes. You went back to the Jacuzzi's home village in Italy.
That was something that was very important to me. I didn't want it to be a book that I research from behind my desk. I have a little phrase that I use about the book, that it's a post-Google book. And that's not being derogatory about Google, because that's a fantastic research tool. I use it all the time, of course. But I think that as a writer, then you need to go one step further.
Now, you end your book with that first spark, with the Reverend Guppy himself, who was apparently quite a character and not actually a clergyman at all.
That's right. He was a British guy. And he ran away from home probably in the 1840s and ended up in Trinidad in his early 20s and settled down. And he became a pillar of the establishment. And like a lot of Victorian gentlemen, he was very interested in the natural world. And he spent a lot of time collecting samples. He got a freshwater fish from a little stream north of Port of Spain and sent it to the British Museum in London.
And let me break in here and say, I love the part where you talk about actually finding the guppy, the fish that the Reverend Guppy sent to the British Museum. They still have it in a glass jar.
In a tiny little glass jar. And they brought out this tiny little jar and tipped the contents into a dish and started prodding it with a little wooden stick. And I thought, hang on a minute, this is the guppy of all guppies. You know, are we allowed to do this? And they said, no, it's fine. Now, the fish expert at the British Museum at the time named it, as often happens, after the person who'd found it. Then a few years later, the fish expert realised, or somebody told him, that the fish had actually already been named. So he had to revert it to an earlier Latin name, but the guppy stuck. And eventually I had discovered that he wasn't a reverent. He's often cited as being a reverent guppy. And I found a photo of him with a high collar, looked like a dog collar for a vicar in England. And he designed it himself, and he wore that around town. And sure enough, when people saw it, they thought he was a clergyman.
And the reason he invented this high collar?
Because he didn't like wearing ties. There you go. And at the end of the book, I'm sitting next to this wonderful stream in Trinidad at exactly the point where a century and more ago he had fished out his guppy. And fantastically, the stream was full of guppies. And I realised that Robert Guppy wasn't a reverent. The guppy should never have been called a guppy. And as far as I could tell, he'd never owned an aquarium. But that was the whole point, because the book is about a journey to discover stories. And facts are elusive things like guppies. They flitter and flicker past you.
Author Philip Dodd, he wrote The Reverend Guppy's Aquarium. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Don't bother checking Amazon for this book. Saddam Hussein, From Birth to Martyrdom, is the title. The author's name, inscribed in gold calligraphy on the cover, is Robert Fisk. It was published in Cairo. But Robert Fisk, a well-known correspondent for Britain's The Independent, never wrote the book, or in fact any biography of Saddam Hussein. But when he saw this volume, he decided to go to Cairo to try to meet the author of the book and the fraud. Robert Fisk joins us from his home in Ireland. Mr. Fisk, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
If you were to write a Saddam biography, it wouldn't be anything like the book you read, or at least half read.
Well, the book I read was boring, and it's very soft on Saddam's use of gas against Halabja. But I did decide I'd better find out if I could get the culprit. The best-known forger in Egypt is known as Magdi Shukri. So I went to the Ministry of Culture and eventually got into the censor's office. Every book that goes on sale in Egypt has to be passed by the censor. And a friend of mine said, if this guy wanted to sell his book, he'd have to put it through the censor. And sure enough, he had. Eventually, in this room, I came across a guy with a computer, and I said, Saddam Hussein, Birth to Martyrdom. And he said, Robert Fisk, by Robert Fisk. And I said, yes, that's the one. He said there was no name for the person who had cleared it through the censor, but there was an address for the man who had forged it. Number 13 Hassan Ramadan Street. So Detective Inspector Fisk jumped into his taxi, and I'd already told the taxi man the story, because if you want to move around Cairo with a taxi, the thing is to let the taxi man know why you're doing it, because then he becomes interested in the story. So we raced off to number 13 Hassan Ramadan Street, only to find it was an underground mosque. And behind it was this rickety, terrible tenement. And then this lady came out of the building next to the mosque. And I said, is there anyone here involved in publishing? And she said, no, not anymore. But there was that nice Magdi Shukri who left a year ago. But he now works around the corner in the Maqbooli bookshop.
And?
Well, I got the driver to reverse through all these donkey carts and people shouting and screaming that we're going the wrong way down the street. So I got to my bully bookshop, and it, blocking the doorway was a man in a yellow smoking jacket with black velvet lapels smoking a cigarette on a holder. And I said, good morning, good morning. You know, I'm looking for a book about Saddam Hussein. And my eyes moved around the shop, and I saw the cover of this forgery in the front window. Now, I suspect he's Magdi Shukri, but he says his name is Mahmoud. So I said, how many have you sold? And he says, we've sold 100 already in this shop alone. So I produced my card, and I said, well, this is me, and you forged it. I want 3,000 Egyptian pounds. And he said to me, but you can't, you didn't write it. At which point I said, well, I want a telephone number for Magdi Shukri, at which point he gives me two telephone numbers, one of which is for a woman who answers the phone, who won't say what her name is, and the other number, as I ring it, I see Mahmoud switching off his mobile phone. Anyway, I did get the bookshop owner, Mr. Mahmoud, to pose with me in front of my book, where he's smiling broadly at his profits, and I'm looking extremely angry. And it seemed to me that's the way to do the story, because if you go to Egypt to investigate a forgery, you simply cannot take it seriously. And if you become a big British Raj and wag your finger, you're an idiot.
Mr. Fisk, Mr. Yep. Shukri, whatever you call yourself, nice to
talk. No, I'm Mr. Robert, don't worry.
All right. Nice talking to you.
You're welcome, bye-bye.
Robert Fisk of The Independent, speaking with us from his home in Ireland. A collection of his Saturday columns is going to appear this spring, called The Age of the Warrior.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Read Fred Kaplan's book about how the U.S. got into Iraq, and you'll come away with no doubt about one thing. Ideas matter, even bad ones. Today's provocative speech at some think tank symposium, or this month's task force report written in the bowels of some federal agency, this year's intelligence estimate, they just might produce next year's policy, if not the next decade's war. Kaplan's book is called Daydream Believers, How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power, so his verdict on the ideas in question is evident. Fred Kaplan writes about the military, most recently for Slate.com, and we're going to hear about a couple of the ideas that he writes about in the book, military transformation and the abolition of tyranny. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
First, military transformation in Pentagon speak circa 2002. What did it mean?
It meant that with the new high-technology weapons, especially bombs that can land within a few feet of their target and computerized surveillance systems that can look at the entire battlefield at one time, you don't need large armies to defeat enemy armies or to topple regimes. You can go in with a very light force and win the war in a matter of days or weeks.
As people were planning for the invasion of Iraq, could they look to Afghanistan or perhaps even to Bosnia before that and claim some experience of success?
Well, they looked at Afghanistan where, you know, the army had told Rumsfeld, to overthrow the Taliban government, we'll need to send two armored divisions through Pakistan. So then they put together this force of Northern Alliance guerrillas, insurgents, with a few special forces and some smart bombs, and they overthrow the government just like that. Now, what they didn't realize at the time was that the Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters still existed. They were out of government, but they were still fighting. But Rumsfeld used that as inspiration during the run-up to the war in Iraq when the army generals were telling him, we're going to need 300,000 troops. He was thinking, yeah, that's what you told me about Afghanistan. And the interesting thing is, in terms of just defeating the Iraqi army and overthrowing Saddam's government, he was right. And the generals were wrong, but he didn't stop to realize that winning a battle does not mean winning a war, that wars are fought for political objectives, and until those objectives are realized, the war isn't over yet.
Donald Rumsfeld has become synonymous, almost iconic, with that decision about how to go to war in Iraq. But actually, there are many other defense policy intellectuals who are contributing to these ideas over the years preceding Iraq.
Well, these ideas about transformation, yeah, it didn't spring full-blown out of Donald Rumsfeld's brain. It was an idea that had been nurtured within the Pentagon and certain think tank circles since the mid-70s. And there were a series of think tank intellectuals, including a man named Andrew Marshall, who is the director of an office called the Office of Net Assessment in the Pentagon. He has held this position since 1973. He is still there. He's about 86 years old. And he and some others came up with these ideas about how you could maintain American preeminence as the Cold War is coming to an end, and as you can no longer raise large armies, and as you might have to go fight wars here and there where we don't have bases and where you can't insert large amounts of ground forces. So these ideas had been springing forth and evolving for 30 years when Rumsfeld hatched onto them.
Now, another idea, and that is that the embrace of freedom by other countries and the abolition of tyranny should be a central aim of U.S. foreign policy. Those ideas are really at odds with what people thought about the first President Bush's conduct of foreign policy, and even with what was written about and on behalf of the second President Bush as he was running for president.
That's right. George W. Bush came into office. It would have been a fair assumption to think that this guy was going to be a realist, maybe even a moderate internationalist. Condoleezza Rice wrote an article in Foreign Affairs. It was the Campaign 2000 issue where she laid out what the Republican foreign policy was. Just, you know, what's important is balance of power, this business of going around the world using force for moral purposes is really misguided. September 11th happens, that changed, and then Bush started talking about freedom is a gift from God, and the point of our foreign policy will be to smash tyranny and spread freedom around the globe. That mainly came or was inspired by Natan Sharansky, the Soviet dissident. Just after Bush won the 2004 election, a friend of his gave him an advance copy of Sharansky's book. Bush told several interviewers that if you want to know what my foreign policy is going to be, read this book, and set about putting it in motion.
Yeah. By that time, Sharansky had, of course, been long freed from the Soviet Union, had been a minister in the Israeli government and then out of the Israeli government, and he drew a distinction between free societies and fear societies. And in that dichotomy, the U.S., it was argued, should be the advocate of free societies everywhere.
Everywhere. And don't be fooled, he said, by these people who think that democracies can't come to Arab countries. That's what they said about Russia as well. Well, you know, in retrospect, maybe they were right about Russia. But what Sharansky sort of realized, but not fully, and what Bush didn't recognize at all, is that, you know, this is a beautiful idea, but it can't just be transplanted. You have to have a government that can mediate conflicts within social groups and do so without causing rancor and violence. And the countries where he thought this could just happen automatically, it didn't work that way. You know, when Bush said freedom is a gift from God, I mean, if you really believe that, if you're not just saying it as a bromide, if you really believe it, it has profound implications, because what that says is that freedom is the default mode of humanity. You hold an election, voila, you've got democracy. I mean, even in this country, freedom, democracy, these things are incredibly difficult to establish and even harder to sustain. It takes real effort. I don't think it's the natural state of mankind at all.
The case for advancing democracy all throughout the Middle East, the administration appears to have cooled off on that over the past year or so. On questions of military transformation, have lessons of Iraq, has the experience of Iraq in any way returned back through the loop to the Pentagon and caused some rethinking of military strategy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's been a huge reckoning on this issue. People now realize that, okay, these smart bombs and this computerized weaponry is very useful for part one of the war, but that's just part one. And the others, the subsequent parts require the good old-fashioned stuff, boots on the ground, good intelligence, knowledge of the culture and language, time and money. And the question is, if they had realized that at the start, would they have gotten into this mess to begin with?
Fred Kaplan, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Fred Kaplan, the author of Daydream Believers, How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here's the headline from some of the news we're following here today at NPR News. Former governor of Massachusetts Mitt Romney withdrew his presidential nomination bid earlier today, speaking to the Conservative Political Action Conference here in Washington, D.C. Senator John McCain addressed that same conference later in the day. We'll hear some remarks from Senator McCain in a few minutes on this program, more later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. There's a story, maybe true, maybe not, of a challenge to Ernest Hemingway. Write a story in just 6 words. For sale, he wrote, baby shoes, never worn. A couple of years ago, the online magazine Smith adapted that challenge and asked readers to send the stories of their lives in just 6 words. Thousands have since arrived, some from famous people. Stephen Colbert wrote, well, I thought it was funny. Most from folks like you and me. I especially like Jancy Dunn's ABCs, MTV, SATs, THC, IRA, NPR. So tell us your life story in 6 words. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. I've posted my own 6-word memoir on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation, and you're welcome to share yours there as well. Many of the best submissions to Smith Magazine have been collected in a new book called Not Quite What I Was Planning, 6-word memoirs by writers famous and obscure. Editors Rachel Fershleiser and Larry Smith join us now from our bureau in New York, and thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Neil.
And I can't believe the passion and interest that this excited since we announced it, what, less than 40 minutes ago or so. We've gotten hundreds of emails, people sending in six-word memoirs. What a great idea.
It's a passion we share with you. When we posted the idea on our site about a year and a half ago, Smith Magazine, we said, can you tell a life story in six words, like Hemingway did? He told fiction. We're a memoir site, a storytelling magazine. 15,000 people in 2 months came bursting through our doors. They had so much to say. They were funny. They were sad. We were blown away by what people were capable of. And frankly, it really reassured us about the power of personal storytelling.
And reassured people that in a world where people are prolix to the nth degree, that people can be terse.
Well, less is more. Brevity is the soul of it and the soul of wit. And you really, it boils down to life's essence. We, in the book, we have both famous folks and non-famous folks. Most of it are folks who've never been published anywhere. They're not going to write for The New Yorker. They're not going to have a best-selling memoir. And then other folks are very well known. Mario Batali, how many words have been written about Molto Mario? Amazing character. I love all those words about him. He sent in seven life stories. The one we have in the book is Brought It to a Boil Often.
And that's a great one. Yet, Rachel, a lot of these are, well, very, very personal, almost painful, some of them.
Yeah, we were really amazed. I think at first we thought people would try to be funny, they'd be clever, they'd be pithy. But people were so honest. People talked about how lonely they were, things they regretted. They really shared their sadness and fears, and it was really incredible.
Still brewing coffee for two. I'm not sure I got all the six words in there, but
I still make coffee for
I
two.
I still make coffee for two. And yet, as you point out in the introduction to your book, you might have thought that reading it initially might have been a widower. It turns out?
He's about 28 or 29. He lives in San Francisco. He had just broken up with a girlfriend, and he was really upset. And he's a lot better now. But it's amazing what you don't necessarily know about people.
And some of these are about roads not taken, children not had, children who died.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were so generous, these contributors, sharing their personal stories. I've been in touch with almost all 800 of them, and they've sent me pictures. The guy who wrote about the dead children had sent us a photo of these two tiny headstones that was so heartbreaking, and he was just willing to share it with strangers because I think sharing your story really helps in a lot of ways.
Let's share some of the ones we've gotten in by email. This from Reverend Jim, abandoned, adopted, Catholic, police officer, family, transformed. Redemptive. A lot of the ones seem to be redemptive, too.
You see life themes. There's a lot of stories in this book, 832. But you do see some common things, religion, babies, children, regrets. It's interesting. We got a lot of actually a number about Mormons, you know, in the news today. About 5 minutes before we came on, I looked at the site because they keep coming in all the time. And Brian Duncan, we don't know Brian Duncan, he tells us, not Mormon, I'm microphone singer now.
Here's one we got, and Rye comes up a lot, too. From Joey in Tucson, Arizona. Musician for life. Fries with that?
Burgers and fries did seem to be a sub-theme. A six-word memoir in the book is, I make burgers and fries.
There's actually a fries section in the index.
A fries section in the index. Let's get Carol on the line. Carol's calling us from Fremont, California.
Hi.
Hi, Carol. What's your six-word memoir?
Left-handed lesbian Polish rocket scientist.
Wow.
That's a good one.
Carol's got a lot going on. It reminds me of one of my favorites. Boyfriend in bed, still a lesbian.
Carol, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to Hector. Hector's with us from Arcata in California. Hector, you there?
Yeah, right here.
What's your six-word memoir?
Born poor, worked hard, died happy.
That's a good one, Hector. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Would you want that, Hector, on your headstone?
Yeah, that wouldn't be bad.
That's not so bad.
No.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. That summing up the life in a few pithy words, that's part of the aim of what you're going here for.
Well, some of the stories are quite universal. Life is circular, caring for parents. Almost anyone can relate to that. Other stories tell a very, very personal narrative story. After Harvard, had baby with crackhead. Now, most of us didn't go to Harvard. Most of us didn't have a baby with a crackhead. But we can understand what that woman went through. She had an amazing life experience, and in six words, we've gotten a whole story. Very personal.
Here's one of those circular ones. This is from David in Little Rock. Sleep, work, eat, rinse, and repeat. Let's do, this is Matt. Matt with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, mine's good bad luck, bad good luck.
That's not too bad either. And again, might fit on the headstone.
Yeah, not too bad.
And that reminds us why the number six is just so magical. Something works about it. You have the symmetry of three and three, and you have the two, 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 and it. We, for whatever reason, five isn't the word, and it's not seven. Six words is the way to tell a short, short life story.
Whose was it that, and thanks very much for the call, Matt, whose was it that was on the seventh word he rested?
That's Stephen Dubner, the co-editor of Freakonomics. Co-author, sorry, we're co-editors.
Let's see if we can go now to, this is Brend. Brend with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi.
Hi, Brend.
Hi, my story would be, never loved, always rejected, good anyway.
Huh. Wow. And you know what I like so much about what Brenda said is that the first two words she said were my story. And as we see these six-word memoirs come in on our site and we collected the best, for, not so much the best, but a selection for the book, each time I see a six-word memoir come in the site, a little, you know, bell goes off. My heart just races a beat because it just means so much that people are willing to be so intimate with perfect strangers. And to tell your story, as you know, there's all sorts of great storytelling avenues these days. To tell your story, I think, is the start of something, you know, bigger and better maybe in your own life.
Brenda, thanks very much.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. Let's talk with Brian. Brian's with us from Rehoboth, Delaware.
Hi.
You there, Brian?
Yeah, how you doing?
Very well, thanks. You're on the air. Go ahead. What's your six-word memoir?
Oh, gifted, anguished, medicated, phoenix, potential, exercised.
All right. Thanks very much for that. Here's an email we got from Roxanne. It says it needs to be done in a Germanic Heidi Klum accent, which I'm not going to try to approximate on the radio. Either you're in or you're out. Defending an America like a farmer would. That's from Major Walker, who's interested, wanted to send that in. My six words, writes Joe Neuse, I knew, don't know, might know. And there's a lot of them like that in this book, too.
Well, there's a lot of hope and optimism across the book. There's the whole range of emotions. It's a fun little book, you know. But on the other hand, you're flipping through it, and you go through a whole range of emotions, anguish, laughter, candor, intimacy. It's a very weird experience to go through the book and realize how close you feel to some of these folks.
Probably worried for nothing, I know. That from Alyssa in Tucson, Arizona. Indiana Jones in the female form from Jana in Napa, California. My beautiful wife is my life. That from Al. And there are certainly tributes and, of course, a lot of painful recollections of significant others in the book.
Absolutely. We have one from a young widower who sent me a picture of his beautiful bride. People are willing to share so much. But despite how sad some of it can be, most of all, the book is fun. People pass it around. People make them up for each other. You bring it to a dinner party and conversations just go crazy. I really think that the fun of it sort of overtakes the sadness, but I'm glad that it has both.
Libby writes us from Sacramento, California. As an avid knitter, I've been assured by my family that my six-word memoir will also be my epitaph. Just let me finish this row.
I think we've all been there. There's a woman named Michelle who's in the book, and she says, we were our own Springer episode. Who hasn't felt that at some point in their life, if not, frankly, each day?
Here's one from Lisa in Tallahassee, 51, and still in school.
There were a lot about higher ed.
Yes. Melissa writes us, as a mother, paraeducator, and horticulturalist, I painted, I nurtured, they grew. So that's people looking almost for adages sometimes.
There's some of that. There's some of life philosophies that come out. One of my favorite is a very light one, but it says so much about this woman. A sundress can cure life's woes. A sundress has cured many of my woes, and I wasn't even wearing the sundress.
This one from Mike in Charlotte, North Carolina. Fork in road, took left turn. And words of wisdom, how can I? That from Steve Griffin in Tampa, Florida. And inevitably, Larry Smith and Rachel Ferschleiser, you're going to be asked for your own six-word memoirs.
Absolutely. Mine is bespectacled, besneakered, read and ran around. I sort of invented the word besneakered, but I really think it speaks to me.
It's going to be in the OED next edition.
Thanks.
And yours, Larry?
A little tricky for the radio. but you can come up with whatever image you like. Big hair, big heart, big hurry.
Rachel Fershleiser and Larry Smith are co-editors of the book that's called Not Quite What I Was Planning, Six-Word Memoirs by Writers Famous and Obscure. They're collected from Smith Magazine, which is an online publication. And is this, you think that you're going to be soliciting these for as long as you can imagine?
As long as they keep coming, we'll keep taking them in. It's amazing to go on the site. We feature some of our favorites every day. And if you can't get enough, you can read all of them as they come in. It's an overwhelming amount of wonderful life stories, six words at a time.
Thank you both very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Neil.
Larry Smith and Rachel Fershleiser joined us from our bureau in New York. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
The frenzy of home buying and home renovation has tailed off or fallen off a cliff in some parts of the country. But for many people, housing is still an obsession.
My interest in looking at realestate.com every single day is it's like this secret little thing that people do. And it's like this relaxing little ritual. And it's something about looking for home, but it's also something about being fascinated by the ups and the downs of the housing market.
Rachel Brownell from Bellingham, Washington, is one of the many homeowners that author Dan McGinn writes about in his new book, House Lust. We spoke to McGinn about the book, which explores the psychology behind the recent housing frenzy. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
You know, it sounds like Americans became obsessed with real estate, much the same way they did with stocks in the late 90s. But obsession with one's home when the housing market is high isn't that unusual. It happens periodically in America. Why is it house lust?
Well, I think you're right that Americans have always been somewhat fascinated with homes. But something different really did happen over the last 10 years or so. We had many, many more people buying not just the house they want to live in, but an investment property. We had the rise of HGTV.
House and garden television.
Exactly. I mean, you can now sit on your sofa in prime time and watch entire shows about people shopping for a house, as prosaic as that sounds, and it's their highest rated show.
So you're saying house lust is a sort of psychological version of the McMansion.
Sure. McMansions and the race for larger and larger homes are definitely one example of how people went a little bit crazy for houses over the last few years. I met a woman who was living in one of these houses that measured 9,000 square feet, and I asked her how many bedrooms and how many bathrooms. And when I asked her how many bathrooms, she had to pause because she didn't really know offhand. She had to sort of count on her fingers. If you look at the average square footage of homes in the U.S. and how they've grown over the years, it really is extraordinary. If you think your house is going to go up by 10% a year, which some people started to think, it only makes sense you buy as much house as you can.
Give us a real-world example from your book of house lust.
Renovations really became over the top the last few years. You saw people spending hundreds of thousands of dollars and months, even up to a year, adding really lavish kitchens, family rooms, master suites. One of the things I encountered was renovation therapists who were helping people deal with the very unique stresses and in some cases prescribing medication to help people get through their renovations.
Now that housing prices are static, going down, in what ways is house lust still with us?
Even though we are absolutely in a housing recession and arguably the worst housing market in decades, there are a lot of homeowners that are still ahead of where they were not 2 years ago, but 10 years ago, still have a lot of equity in their homes. Having lived through the real estate boom of the last few years really has transformed the way people think about their homes in the same way that even though the dot-com boom burst, it really did change the way we think about, for instance, working at a startup like a Google or a Facebook, about getting stock options as part of our pay. People seem to be always thinking about their next house and doing things to try to maximize the value of the house they live in now, whether prices are going up or going down. Americans will still spend about $170 billion renovating their homes this year, which is only a little bit less than they were at the peak. I do think having lived through a time when we thought our houses were going to make us rich has changed the way we think about them.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dan McGinn is a reporter for Newsweek magazine and the author of House Lust. If you want to take a quiz to see if you've got a case of house lust, go to npr.org.
It's HGTV's Spice Up My Kitchen.
Whoa! You never know what you might find if walls could talk. I'm Mike Siegel.
I'm Candace Olsen, and this is Divine Design.
We can't have this place go crazy with people misbehaving, because that's when police come around. And then customers stop coming around, and then we don't make our money. Simple as that. and I usually have my guys with me just in case. And he winked at me as if I should know what just in case meant. I didn't.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulabin. This week, Sudhir Venkatesh takes us where many people have never ventured, inside a gang selling crack cocaine. Venkatesh was a sociology graduate student when he decided to survey residents of a notorious Chicago housing project about being poor and black in America. 7 years of immersion in their lives led to his new book, Gang Leader for a Day. Venkatesh wrote two earlier books called American Project and Off the Books, and he pops up in the bestseller Freakonomics. His research informed a chapter called Why Do Drug Dealers Still Live with Their Moms? This reading of Gang Leader for a Day was recorded in January of 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Good evening. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about myself, read a couple passages from the book, and then make a couple closing comments, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions that you folks have. So I am a faculty member in sociology and African American studies at Columbia University. I've been there for 8-9 years or so, and I mostly write for audiences of about 15 or 20 people. In my profession, and articles and books. The context for this book is the context of my work for the past 20 years, and that is the Robert Taylor Homes public housing developments in Chicago. And just to put it in perspective, I know that Washington actually has gone through demolition and redevelopment of a lot of its public housing as well, so this is a nationwide phenomenon that the Robert Taylor Homes no longer exist. The last building came down in 2006. And if you haven't been to Chicago or if you haven't seen one of these places, they're quite staggering to the eye. 30,000 people in a 2-mile stretch of land and 16-story structures, and they occupy only 7% of the physical space. So it's a vast concrete and grass expanse. And my journey into this place began in an awkward way, and they make a nice caricature of it in Freakonomics, and which is not actually far from the truth. I'm not the most intelligent of people when it comes to finding my way around. And I actually did have a survey in my hand, and I walked into this community, and I was trying to impress William Julius Wilson. I had just arrived at the University of Chicago, and I thought, okay, I'm a mathematician. I have no background in sociology. I just have a math degree. I'm going to devise some questions, and I'm going to go into these neighborhoods and try to contribute to his research projects, and there was a study, I believe, in Los Angeles and Detroit comparing youth, and in that survey they were looking at different ways to ask people about their experiences in poverty, and I constructed this question: how does it feel to be black and poor? And put these responses: very bad, bad, neither bad nor good, good, very good. And I thought, you know, that's where I'll. Why not just begin with the most obvious statement? And I never got past the first statement, first question. As soon as I asked it to these folks who I met in this very crowded stairwell in the housing developments, they looked and they just had absolutely. They were dumbfounded that a university could produce this subpar performance, and I don't think they would. Their minds would be changed, alas. And so I, at the invitation of this very, very charismatic street gang leader named JT, I came back the next day. They kept me in there for overnight. I just had come off the tour of a Grateful Dead, so my mind was already a little numb. So I was just too numb to be scared. I don't think I was really scared. I just felt like I was in a different territory with these folks. I didn't really know what to think about. And this guy was a really charismatic, very intelligent young man, a little older than me, and we developed this, I would say probably a friendship, but also a mutual curiosity for each other over the next decade. He took me into his world, and I tried his best to convince him that sociology still had a place in society, and although the questionnaire I began with didn't give him much confidence. And so this book is really a journey about this. This book is really a journey of a relationship between JT and me, and how we managed each other. For a long time, he thought I was going to be his personal biographer, and he really thought that I was going to be his voice and give him a kind of legitimation. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. But that really sets up the first passage that I want to read, which is that I stumbled upon this place. I'd come from Southern California, not really knowing anything about the city and not knowing anything about life outside of the West Coast. And here I meet this person who I think is going to be I'm just drawn to him and to the street gang. And it's about 18 months in, and he starts taking me around the buildings in Robert Taylor. And the passage that I want to read to you gives you a sense of how I was given a tour by this person, because I think sometimes these kinds of methodologies where you go and you hang out and then all of a sudden a book is produced, it can be pretty opaque. But here, this is quite literally how he would take me through some of these places. So just let me read you a couple pages of this. JT had by now firmly established his reign over a group of three buildings, one on State Street, two on Federal, each of which he'd like to walk through at least once a week. You have the CHA, the landlord, but then we also try to make sure that people are doing what they're told, he explained as we walked. We can't have this place go crazy with people misbehaving, because that's when police come around, and then customers stop coming around, and then we don't make our money, simple as that. As we entered the lobby of one of his buildings, he grabbed a few of his foot soldiers and told them to follow us. I always start with the stairwells, JT said, and there were three stairwells per building. And I usually have my guys with me, just in case, and he winked at me as if I should know what just in case meant. I didn't, and I kept quiet. We began climbing. It was only 11 on a weekday morning, but already the stairwells and landings were crowded with people drinking, smoking, hanging out. The stairwells were poorly lit and unventilated, and they smelled vile. There were puddles whose provenance I was happy not to know. The steps themselves were dangerous, many of the metal treads loose or missing. On the fifth floor, we came upon three older men talking and laughing, and JT looked them over. You're all staying on the 11th floor, right? He asked. No, said one of them without looking up. We moved to 1206. Oh, to 1206, and who said you could do that? None of them answered. Well, you need to settle up if you're in 1206 because you're supposed to stay in 1102, right? The men just cradled their beer cans, heads down, stung by this scolding. JT called out to one of his foot soldiers. Hey, Creepy, get these guys over to T-Bone. T-Bone, I knew, was one of JT's closest friends and one of his senior officers. As we resumed our climbing, I asked JT what had just happened. Squatters, he said. See, a lot of people who live around here don't have a lease. They just hang out in the stairs because it's too cold outside or they need a safe place. Maybe they're running from the police. Maybe they just owe somebody money. We provide them protection. The gang protects the squatters, I asked. Oh, yeah, but no one messes with them if they're in here. I make sure of that. But we can't have 2 million of them, so we have to keep track, and they pay us. As we continued our climb, we occasionally passed an older woman wearing a blue tenant patrol jacket. There were about a dozen of these women in each building, JT said. They make sure the old folks are doing okay, he told me, and sometimes we help them. And somewhere around the 13th floor, JT stopped when he saw a tenant patrol woman bent over a man who was squirming on the floor. Good morning, Ms. Easley, JT said. The man looked like he was just waking up, but I could also smell vomit, and he seemed to be in pain. He lay right outside the incinerator room, and the garbage smelled terrible. Oh, he's coming down, Ms. Easley told JT. He said somebody sold him some bad stuff. Mm-hmm, JT said disapprovingly. That's what they all say when something goes bad, always blaming it on us. Yeah, baby, but we can't have him sitting here. JT waved over the remaining foot soldier, Barry, who was trailing us. Get a few guys and take this man down to 50th, Barry. 50th referred to the Robert Taylor Medical Clinic on 50th Street. All right, Ms. Easley, JC said, but if I see him here tomorrow and he's saying the same shit, Creepy is going to beat his ass. JT laughed. Without my prodding, JT talked about what we had just seen. Crackheads, he said. Sometimes they mix stuff, crack, heroin, alcohol, medicine, and they just can't see straight in the morning. Someone on the tenant patrol finds them and helps them. Well, why don't you just call an ambulance, I asked. JT looked at me skeptically. Are you kidding? These folks almost never come out here when we call, or it takes them an hour. So you guys bring them to the hospital. Well, I don't like my guys doing anything for them, but once in a while I guess I feel sorry for them. But that's Creepy's decision. He's the one who runs the stairwell. The stairwells, JT explained, were the one public area in the building where the gang allowed squatters to congregate. These areas inevitably became hangout zones for drug addicts and the homeless. JT's foot soldiers working in shifts were responsible for making sure that no fights broke out there. It's not a pretty job, JT told me, laughing, but that's how they learned to deal with people, learned to be tough on them. The gang didn't charge the squatters much for staying in the building, and JT let the foot soldiers keep most of the squatter tax. This was one of the ways foot soldiers could earn money, since they held the lowest rank in the gang's hierarchy and weren't even eligible yet to sell drugs. From JT's perspective, allowing his foot soldiers to police the stairwell served another important function. It let him see which junior members of his gang showed the potential for promotion. We kept climbing until we reached the top floor, the 16th. I followed JT down the hallway till we came to an apartment without a front door. JT told our foot soldier escort to stand guard outside. The young man nodded obediently. And following JT inside, I was hit by a noxious odor of vomit, urine, and burned crack. It was so dark I could barely see. There were several mattresses spread about, some with bodies on them, and piles of dirty clothing and fast food wrappers. The holes in the wall were stuffed with rags to keep out the rats. "Hey, Sudhir, come over here," JT shouted. "See this?" He pointed to a row of beat-up refrigerators. "This is where the squatters keep their food." Each fridge was draped with a heavy chain and a padlock. "Well, where do they get the fridges?" I asked. "Well, from the housing authority," JT said, laughing. "The CHA managers sell fridges to the squatters for a few bucks instead of taking them back to get fixed. See, everyone is in on it. That's one thing you're going to learn about the projects." JT explained that this apartment was a regular squat, which meant that the people sleeping there paid the gang a rental fee and were therefore allowed to keep food and clothes inside. 10 people squatted inside this apartment, and a squatter known as C-Note, who had been in the community for more than 2 decades, was their leader. It was C-Note's duty to screen other squatters who wanted to take up quarter there, to help them find food and shelter and make sure they obeyed all of JT's rules. "Well, we let C-Note run things inside," JT says, "as long as he pays us and does what we say." Outside the squat, I sat down on the gallery floor, finally able to take a clear breath. I felt overwhelmed by all of this new information hitting me, and I told JT I needed a rest. He smiled. He seemed to understand. And he told me he'd survey the other 2 buildings by himself. I started to resist, worried that I might not have this chance again, and JT read my mind. "Oh, don't worry, Mr. Professor, I do this every week." So this was the first, this is what I would do for the first 18 months, is I don't know if you've ever been in the playground and you've seen school teachers tie the kids together with those little plastic tubes. I felt like I was tied to JT. I would just walk behind him, and I was felt like I was controlled. I saw the world that he wanted me to see, and the world that he was opening up to me was a very controlled world, and it was the world of a mob boss. It was the world of this politician who everyone who could walk down the street, or in this case, walked up the stairwells, and everyone said hi to him. He took out a few dollars, gave it to somebody. People whispered to him. Everyone knew his name. He knew everybody else's name, and he just thoroughly enjoyed having me alongside. I was this person that I think represented the outside world, and I think he was deeply interested in where this relationship could go. He had a self-interest, clearly. I ended this little passage with this squatter named C-Note. And C-Note was one of another kind of a community leader who had been in this place as long as JT, been in public housing, and he had command over this building, and he controlled the squatters, and he also had a very important economic function to play. He was a car mechanic, but he could also, for example, make sure that every apartment was fixed because the housing authority wouldn't fix anything. So C-Note was the janitor and the superintendent of the building. My relationship with JT changed very quickly and abruptly as I started to see more sides of this person and as he started to unravel. And I'm going to read you a little shorter paragraph, shorter passage, in which for the first time I see another side of him, the less than benevolent side of this street gang leader. On a hot Sunday morning, I was hanging out with C-Note and some other squatters in the parking lot of JT's building across the street from a basketball court. C-Note and the men had set up an outdoor auto repair shop, changing tires, pounding out dents, performing minor engine repairs. The prices were low, and they had lined up enough business to keep them going all day. Cars were parked at every angle in the lot. The men moved to and fro, hauling equipment, swapping tools, and chattering happily at the prospect of so much work. Another squatter had set up a nearby stand to sell soda and juice out of the cooler. I bought a drink and sat down to watch the underground economy in full bloom. JT drove up, accompanied by four of his own senior officers, and three more cars pulled up behind them. I recognized several other gang leaders from other neighborhoods, JT's counterparts who ran the other local Black Kings factions in the city. JT walked over to C-Note, who was peering in a car engine. JT didn't notice me. I was sitting by a white van, partially hidden from view, but I could see and hear him just fine. C-Note, JT yelled. What the hell are you doing? What the hell does it look like I'm doing, young man? C-Note barked right back, looking up from his work. C-Note wasn't usually quarrelsome, but he could be a hard liner when it came to making his money. Well, we have basketball games running today, JT said. He meant the gang's monthly basketball tournament. Now, you need to get this stuff out of here. Move these cars. Get all this stuff out of the court. Oh, you should have told me, C-Note said. C-Note threw an oily cloth to the ground. What the hell can I do? You see, I got work here. We ain't finished. JT laughed. He seemed surprised that someone would challenge him. Are you kidding me? I don't give a damn about your work. Get these cars out of here. JT looked underneath the cars. Oh, damn. You got oil all over the place, too. You better clean that up. C-Note started waving his hands about and shouting at JT. You're the only one who can make money? Is that it? Is that right? You own all this shit? You own this land? C-Note pulled out a cigarette, lit it, and kept muttering bullshit. The other squatters stopped working to see what would happen next. C-Note was drenched in sweat and angry, as if he might lose control. JT looked down at his feet and then waved over his senior officers who had been waiting by the car. A few of the other gang members also got out of their cars. And once his henchmen were near, JT spoke again to C-Note softly. I'm asking you one more time. You either move this car or... Oh, that's some bullshit, boy, C-Note yelled. I'm not going anywhere. I've been here for 2 hours, and I told you I ain't finished working. You do this every time, he turned to the other squatters. He does this every time. C-Note was still chattering when JT grabbed him by the neck. In an instant, two of JT's officers also grabbed C-Note. The three of them dragged C-Note toward a concrete wall that separated Robert Taylor from the tracks where a commuter train ran. C-Note kept shouting, but he didn't physically resist. The other squatters turned to watch. And the gang leaders nonchalantly took some sodas from the cooler without paying. Now, you can't do this to us, C-Note shouted. It's not fair. JT pushed C-Note up against a concrete wall. The two officers, their muscular arms plastered with tattoos, pinned C-Note in. I told you, JT said, his face barely an inch away from C-Note's, but you just don't listen, do you? JT sounded exasperated, but there was also a sinister tone to his voice I'd never heard before. Why are you making this harder? He started slapping C-Note on the side of the head. He grunted with each slap, and C-Note's head flopped back and forth like a little toy. The hell with you, C-Note shouted. He tried to turn to look JT in the eye, but JT was so close to him that C-Note butted the side of JT's head with his own. This only irked JT more, so he cocked his arm and pounded C-Note in the ribs. C-Note held his gut, coughing violently, and then JT's henchmen pushed him to the ground. They took turns kicking him, one in the back and the other in the stomach, and when C-Note curled up, they kicked him in the legs. You should have listened to the old man, fool, one of JT's officers shouted. C-Note lay in a fetal position, struggling to catch his breath. JT rolled over him and punched him in the face one last time. He shouted and then walked back toward us, head down, flexing his hand as if he'd hurt it on C-Note's skull. JT reached into the squatter's cooler for a soda, and that's when he finally noticed me standing there. He frowned when our eyes met. He quickly moved away. He went toward the high-rise, but his look gave me a chill. He was clearly surprised to see me, and he seemed a little peeved. I had been hanging around JT and his gang for several months by now, and I'd never seen JT engage in violence. I felt like his scribe, tailing a powerful leader who liked to joke with the tenants and, when he needed to be assertive, did so quietly. I was naive, I suppose, but I had somehow persuaded myself that just because I hadn't seen any violence, it didn't exist. And now I had seen a different side of his power, a far less polished presentation. And in the weeks afterward, I began to contemplate the possibility that I would see more beatings, perhaps even fatal incidents. I still felt exhilarated by my access to JT's gang, but I was also starting to feel shame. My conviction that I was merely a sociological observer, detached and objective, was starting to feel false. Was I really supposed to just stand by while someone else was getting beat up? I was ashamed of my desire to get so close to the violence, so close to a culture that I knew other scholars had not managed to see. Little by little, after this incident, almost like a snowball rolling down this hill, two young men, me and JT, I, who had perfected conflict avoidance to this day, and JT, who had loved to loved to confront anything and everybody, ended up having to come to terms with this relationship where I was inexorably drawn to this man and what he was showing me, and he was desperately hopeful that I would paint a picture of him that was favorable, and that, in his words, would be a picture of a community man, as he said. He had modeled himself and styled himself after Big Bill Dawson and many of the other political bosses in Chicago that his grandparents and his uncles and his aunts had told him about, people who, for whom the underworld, the so-called shady world and the mainstream world were linked because there were no other opportunities for African Americans at that time. And he wanted to be a boss, and he fashioned himself in that mold. And I was just all too willing to sort of let myself get into this world more and more and more. And this book is really about the relationship that was forged between us. The result of watching this beating, the result of watching some drive-by shootings, and in one case that I'm happy to talk about later if you want, getting involved in an incident myself, did several things to me, not the least of which is that it raised, as I mentioned, a number of ethical quandaries. Seeing these sorts of incidents and wondering, the mandate that I had as a objective social scientist seemed absolutely, I was incapable of fulfilling it, but yet that's what I was supposed to do, was produce scientific data. Unlike journalists, I was really blessed by being able to move in with families and stay with them for weeks at a time. They let me sleep on their couch. I mean, a journalist will be lucky and kiss his editor or her editor if they get a week on a story, and I had 7 years. So this was an incredible opportunity for me. And the book is really about a set of stories. The book is not just about JT, but about a number of other people, incredibly powerful people in this community who ran the place. One of them that I just want to bring your attention to, because she's an equally important person in this narrative, is Ms. Bailey, a tenant leader. The tenants were allowed to elect their own representatives in the early 1970s in order to influence the housing authority's use of resources and their allocation of resources. And then the housing authority didn't have any more resources to allocate, so the tenant leaders had to find their own money to make to make people happy. They had to find a way to keep apartments fixed. And this person, Ms. Bailey, this very strong American woman who had come up from Arkansas and come up to this development, was an equally powerful influence on me. And from the moment I met her, she disabused me of the notion that I was the expert and she was the informant. And she had just a wonderful style of being able to humble me. And I thought I'd just give you a taste of the way in which she taught me sociology. I witnessed Ms. Bailey's fighting spirit firsthand when I visited her small, decrepit office one day. I wanted to explain why I'd been hanging around her building and explain my research. I began by discussing the prevailing academic wisdom about urban poverty and the factors that contributed to it. "Are you planning on talking with white people in your study?" she snapped, waving her hand at me as if she'd heard my spiel 100 times already. I was confused. "Well, this is a study of the Robert Taylor homes, and I suppose that most of the people I'll be talking to are black, unless there are whites who live here that I'm not aware of. If I give you only one piece of bread to eat each, if I give you only one piece of bread to eat each day, and asked why you're starving, what would you say?" I was thrown off by this seeming non sequitur, and I thought for a minute. "I guess I would say I'm starving because I'm not eating enough," I answered. "Oh, you got a lot to learn, Mr. Professor," she said. "Again, if I give you one piece of bread to eat each day and asked why you're starving, what would you say?" I was getting even more confused, but I took a chance. "Because you're not feeding me," Yes, very good. I felt relieved. I hope no more tests were coming my way. But Ms. Bailey kept going. Let's say I took your house key away and you had to sleep outside, she said. And a man comes from the city. A man from the city comes over and counts you as homeless. Well, what would you say? Well, this one seemed even harder. I tried to buy myself some time. I'd say you're wrong. I have a place to stay. So, no, I'm not homeless. I thought I'd nail this one. But she looked exasperated at my answer. Wow, have you ever had to do anything for yourself? She said. I was at least smart enough to know that she wasn't literally asking me to reply. If I took your house key away, she barked slowly, what does that make you? She leaned across the desk, and I could feel her breath on my face. Well, I guess you robbed me, so I'm not homeless. I'm a victim. Okay, we're getting somewhere. Now, let's say I tell the police to stop coming to your block and to only go where I live. And then I write that you live in a crime-infested neighborhood, that there's more crime on your block than mine. What would you say? Well, I guess I'd say that it's not really fair because you have all the police. So, Mr. Professor, we're really getting moving now. Ms. Bailey threw up her hands in mock celebration. Okay, so let's get back to the original question. You want to understand how black folks live in the projects, why we are poor, why we have so much crime, why we can't feed our families, why our kids can't work when they grow up. So will you be studying white people? Yes, I said. I understood, finally, that she also wanted me to focus on the people outside Robert Taylor who determine how the tenants lived every day. But don't make us the victim, she said. We'll take responsibility for what we can't control, for what we can control. It's just that not everything is in our hands. It was some of the most unpleasant experiences in my life having to go to her office, but they were without parallel, I mean, in terms of being educated as a sociologist. And probably this is the thing that surprised me most, is that I thought I was coming in there to be the expert, and I ended up being humbled practically every day and taught more sociology from these conversations than any of the textbooks that I was reading. And I came in there as a 23-year-old and really without much of a sense of how to live life, how to treat people, and I came there and was educated about everything from how to ask a question to the way in which democracy works. Those are the kinds of things that I never thought that I would find a slice of America in the inner city, not just a slice of poverty. And she was an absolutely incredible person. And there are a number of other people like that who just in their own inimitable way, either through humbling me or just through tolerating me, brought me into their world. And so I felt like this was the right time to write a little book about their stories and what they gave me in return. So maybe with that, I will stop and thank you very much.
So what happened to JT? Where is everybody now, I guess would be the natural question.
In 1995, 1996, the federal government began a series of busts of the Black Kings and various other gangs in the city. And most of the leaders were jailed, and JT was not. And there was great speculation about how he managed to escape. He socked his money away, and today he manages part time a few dry cleaning, a barber salon, and places, a beauty salon, a barber shop, and places for his relatives. And he actually tried, and I describe this in this book. This I can't believe I was feeling sorry for him. If you can imagine that, when the buildings came down, he actually tried to go to a small working lower middle class neighborhood in the city, mixed ethnic, and tried to recruit and start a new gang, because this is what the gang leaders were taught. They existed in this, as Free Economics described them. JT was in the top, but not at the very top, but near the top of a pyramid. And he had a number of gangs that he controlled, and those gangs all represented particular neighborhoods. And when the projects came down, those were gone. So he lost his base. He could still extract money from other people, but you had to have a base. So he would go to these new areas in the city and try to drum up support and try to run a new gang in a new neighborhood. And some of these places, the gang, this was Alfalfa, this is like our gang. These were kids who were 12 and 13 years old. So JT would come in there and give a rousing speech about the Black Kings, and they've been in the city for 40 years and around for 40 years, and this was about Black empowerment and about the money you're going to make. And some little kid would raise his hand and say, does this mean I could buy my 10-speed bike that I want? And he said, no, no, we're not talking about a bike. We're talking about, you know, he'd go through his spiel. This is my car that I drive. And then somebody else says, my sister wants to join. Is that going to be okay if she comes to the next meeting? And he just dropped his head, and he just couldn't believe that this is what he had to deal with, and he just quit. He said, I can't do this anymore. So he started managing these other businesses, but that's it.
I saw online you had spoke to some, you know, gang members about how they felt about something, you know, fictional like The Wire. And I was just wondering if you could elaborate on how, if you think something that's fictional and journalistic like that is accurate anyway.
This is my first attempt at blogging, going from a typewriter to blogging, so it's quite a change for me. I've been posting these weekly. I've been watching episodes of The Wire, the HBO series about Baltimore, with a group of mostly ex-street gang members, high-level street gang members and drug dealers in the New York metropolitan area to get a sense of what they think about the show. They've been making bets on who dies and who's going to survive, you know, $5,000, $10,000 bets, asking me to hold the money, and I kind of kindly refused. But it's fascinating to watch them deconstruct the show. They said one thing to me that I was very surprised at, which is that they said, a white man must have written this show. And I said, why? I said you're all drawn into it. It seems authentic. How would you know? They said, well, it's everything is they were trying to figure out the words for it, and they said everything's kind of flattened out. Everyone has the same relationship to everybody else, but in the real world, that just doesn't work. I said, why? And they said, because white is always on top. And they tried to tell me that no matter what, in that game that the Wire talks about, there's always a hierarchy. It's not just that the politicians are just as crooked as the gang members that are just as crooked as the unions. It's that there's a racial hierarchy. And that showed, and from their point of view, that show didn't really show it. And that was an interesting take, because so much of what people get out of that show from the critics to the blogs is that, everything is too complicated and everyone is good and everyone is evil. And you can't make moral distinctions. But for these guys, they were another kind of distinction. They were putting that into a historical context. I will never forget the first time I went with JT to when he got promoted and joined one of the higher ranking groups of several dozen people who ran all the gangs in the city. And I was shaking. I was so nervous. I was going to the suburban Chicago house, and I thought this was going to be a rap video. I thought it was going to be a lovely pool, and there was going to be lovely women, and there was going to be free beer, and I looked real good, and I went over there. There were like eight guys in a raggedy old house drinking bad beer, and they bought the house for one of the persons bought the house for their mother, who said that she hated it out there. It was too lonely. She didn't know anybody, so she moved back in the projects. And all of the mothers did this, of all of these gang leaders. They bought this property out in these suburbs, and none of their moms wanted to live there, and they all moved back. And then the house is just kind of deteriorated. My illusion was just, it was shattered.
Can you talk more about your relationship with the police and the housing authority? Because your book has some interesting comments about that.
Mm-hmm. I'll say something, and if I don't hit what note you want me to hit, just let me know. When I first got, and I'm not sure if this part is in the book. When I first got to Robert Taylor, I used to go to these community meetings, and I went once after a drive-by shooting, and in which these two, one boy and one girl were hit. One of them died later, and the residents were very upset, as you can imagine. And the community meeting was structured like this. There were chairs, and then there was a senior police officer who came and said, okay, we're going to stop this. We're going to get them. You need to help us. The residents then yelled back at them. The police officer yelled back. And one of the things that came out is that a resident would stand up and say, the police officer, excuse me, would say, well, help us figure out how to secure your neighborhood. And a resident would stand up and say, we need you to fix the lights in our stairwell. And the police officer would say, well, ma'am, that's maintenance.
That's the housing authority. This is law enforcement. Again, help us figure out how to secure your neighborhood. And somebody would say, why can't you put a bathroom where on the fourth floor because the elevators never work and our kids can't come up and they end up peeing in the stairwell. But ma'am, again, that's the housing authority. That's maintenance. We're security. Why can't you clean? And it was just this discord. The residents wanted secured so-called maintenance, and the law enforcement kept saying that that's not their responsibility. And you saw over time what security meant, security for the residents, and it just seems so obvious when in most of the neighborhoods that I've lived in, good street lighting, it's clean, you can walk, you can use public space, and so on. And they couldn't provide that basic good, and the police kept saying, what we can give you is 750 officers who will descend upon your community in a matter of minutes right after a shooting occurs. So that happened in this public view, and I saw this for a while, and I've wondered how the hell does anyone form a truce among these street gangs or keep violence down here. And one day when Mrs. Bailey was nice enough, she said, why don't you wait here or just come back here in 2 hours or you can wait. And I came back and it's the same people except for the residents. It's Ms. Bailey. It's the police commander or police officer. It's Autry Harrison, who became a friend of mine who ran a Boys and Girls Club, a member of the clergy, and then there's two street gang leaders. Closed the door. They let me in. They let me in the room. And they said, okay, so who's fighting whom and why? Well, so-and-so is, you know, using the park for drug dealing and the park is neutral space, once said one gang leader. And we have an agreement that that place can't be used. They said, okay, well, that's a violation. So, you know, Johnny, you get to use that park for 2 weeks. Just, you know, you can sell in that park. And then after that, that stops. Then we go back to the park being a neutral space. So they make these kinds of rules. And there was an entire elaborate back room set of negotiations that the police were involved with, the police, at least just one police officer. And this made me wonder, what the hell is law enforcement doing here? And what does it mean to have social order in this community? And after I saw this several more times, it really put to rest this notion that the police are the guarantors of public order. The police are there to protect families. They just simply were not, in the sense of that the residents had and the police had such bad relationships for 30 years that the only way they were going to get anything done was by this officer coming and helping create this truce. And then they explained to me why. And all of them shared. Every police officer I've ever talked to who works in that inner city, in the inner city of Chicago has and New York, has said the same thing. We can't prevent violence from occurring. We can't prevent any of this. What we can do is make sure that it doesn't go out of control, that it doesn't get out of control, and we can stop it right away. And that's such a different view about policing. That's so different than what I was used to. And that was my introduction to policing and to police officers. And slowly I would start to follow them as they worked formally in a certain way. And then behind the scenes, they had a whole another way of operating and helping the community.
The book Freakonomics makes quite a big point about how it's like a corporation in the sense that it's very top down. But it seems to me that it was more top heavy than a corporation that we know of, in the sense if you take all the money that the managers make and compare it to all the money that the workers make, the ratio is higher in the gang. Did you look into that at all?
The ratio is higher of the amount that the managers versus the...
Yeah, I'd say the gang, the leaders make more total. Not one versus one, but if you add up all the leaders. But I don't really know. I don't get good statistics. I see what's in the paper when there's a strike to know what salaries corporations make.
According to Paul Krugman, I think it probably would be very similar. I guess it depends on what economists you probably want to trust. But, yeah, I mean, it was such a disparity. The kids, there were kids who were making less than minimum wage, and JT was making $100,000 and $150,000 a year and socking it away. And it were these kids who were risking their lives. They had something like a 25%. If they stayed as a member of a street gang, the whole time in which we did our study, 4.5 years, they had a 25% chance of getting killed. I mean, that's incredible. And yet they would do this with the hope that they would eventually be able to rise to that particular level. And it was mystical. That just shows you the lack of opportunities that they had.
I wanted to ask about drug use and abuse, not within the project, but within the actual gang. Do you notice the group dynamics of the gang? Did they steer the gang members towards drug abuse, or was it all the opposite?
I have to say that I saw very, very little drug use among the gang members. It was the one group that just, I mean, narcotics, I'm sorry. So very little narcotics use among the gang members, which surprised me. But the only folks were the ones who were in their late 30s or 40s using. Yeah.
I was wondering, kind of related to something you said earlier, whether you ever felt that your presence was causing someone to do something violent that they wouldn't have otherwise in order to impress you or anything like that, whether you think that happened, and if so, do you feel like that makes you complicit in what happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can give you the page numbers, unfortunately. That happened a number of times. One time, I went back to my university, and this is something I write about in the book, and I had told my advisors that this is where I am in my work, and they said, listen, you're getting in a little deep, we think you should pull back, and we came to a rapprochement. I would try to get data on how much people were making in the community who worked in the underground economy. There was never really good understanding of what the alleyway mechanic, the prostitute, the person who sells food. So they said, okay, fine, do that and then try to get out. So Ms. Bailey and JT both helped me by getting everyone to cooperate with me. And I told them, you can't pressure them, you can't force them, just let me meet them and I'll read them my little protocol. Hi, I'm a researcher, blah, blah, blah. I'd like to ask you how much you're hiding from the government. Of course that JT had nothing to do with it, right? So he introduced these people to me. And the first set of people that he introduced me were this group of pimps, these managers of these prostitutes who were working in the development. And they were in the room, and a couple of them, had black eyes. And I knew one of them, Charlie, I knew him. And I said, what happened? And he wouldn't talk to me, and he said, okay. And all of their women, 150 or something like 100 women are lined up outside the door. And I walk into this room. And he said, okay, go ahead, take who you want. And they all, their heads were down. Some of them had been, looked like they'd be beaten. And I said, well, let me just explain what I want. I just want to ask you some questions about what the risks entail, what you make. He goes, I know you want to work with us. Go ahead. I know you want to work with us. He kept saying, I know you want to work with us. I said, I think there may be a misunderstanding here. And as I started to explain, they started shouting, okay, but you can't take Melissa because Melissa's mine. She's a good earner and I take care of her. And they start laying claims on these women. And then the women would start coming in saying, okay, I'm going to go with him. You're going to take me back over to Hyde Park, right, where the real money is, right? And I thought, okay, that's what JT had told them, that I want to work with them. So I want to be the seventh or however many there were. And when they refused, he just beat them up. So they came to this meeting begrudgingly with their workers in tow, and then I was going to just take my pick, and I felt awful, absolutely awful. The only thing I can say is it gets worse. So I get this information. I'm sort of dizzy. I'm doing this for several weeks. I get this information, and I'm walking around saying, but I'm going to contribute to sound social policy. Convincing myself, right? We're near Washington, I can do that. And so I'm getting all this information and people are talking to me. Then I started to talk to my advisors and they said, you know what, how do you know it's accurate? And they said, they could be just telling you something because the gang leader or Mrs. Bailey's making you tell something. I said, yeah, you're right. So I walked back to JT and Ms. Bailey. I said, you guys, can you do me a favor? Can you just look at this? Can you just look at what I'm getting? Mrs. Jones told me she baked 100 pies and she made $200. You think she's lying? And they're like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, we'll look that over for you. I said, that would be great. So I left and I came back. C-Note, the squatter I talked about, he wouldn't talk to me. He wouldn't talk to me at all. He started saying things like, yeah, boy, you think you can trust somebody and then they just turn on you. And he just wouldn't look me in the eye. And I thought, okay, well, I guess I'll move on. I went to a group of women, and they all scattered. And I started getting really nervous because if no one wants to hang around you, it means that you're either a good target or you smell bad or something like that. You better leave. And what happened was that JT and Ms. Bailey took all of the information, and they taxed everybody that they didn't know was making money illegally. I don't know who got beat up. I don't know what they were taxed. But Mrs. Jones wasn't paying Mrs. Bailey for making those pies. Now she was. And so it got worse. And I came back. I lost this basic level of trust that I had. I think that's page 271. It was so painful to write, I think I remember. And so there were these ways in which I just unwittingly contributed to, you know, taking the livelihood away from people, possibly, certainly in some cases, leading to physical harm, because I had been, you know, and I confronted C-Note, and that's, I should have probably read that part, you know, because I had really thought, okay, I didn't know. And that's when he said, don't lie to me. He says, you've never lied to me. Don't start lying to me. You knew exactly what you were doing. You got caught up in your own hustle. You're a hustler just like us. And you wanted this data. You wanted to make your name. And you didn't care how it was going to affect anyone else. And as soon as I wrote that out in this book, Stephen Dubner helped me a lot kind of shaping the book. And he said, you got to call this chapter The Hustler and the Hustled. And that's what it is, because it's just, that's how they started to see me. In fact, that's how they saw me before from day one. I had something that I wanted. I wanted information. And only I was naive enough to think that in this place you can just go and ask and get information and then walk away. You can if you just want to go one day, get your little story, and then go home. If you're going to stay a while, then you're participating in something. Anyway, sorry for the long answer, but so yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for doing this work and for coming here to share it with us. So after all the time you've spent with this, what do you and what do the people you spent time with think are the most effective ways to change things for the better?
The people that I work with are extremely, only a middle-class bourgeois person like myself would use the word cynical. They just have a very, very real understanding of how power works. And so they are, I wouldn't say that they're hopeless, but they just don't expect a lot. And that's a vague and opaque answer, so let me just give you an example. So the Housing Authority has been moving all of these families who have been living in public housing developments like this. And what they tend to do is they say, okay, you're a leaseholder, take your kids, and you'll move to a new place. But you're never living with just your kids. You're living with your aunt, you're living with somebody else, or all these people. And you're in all of these incredible exchange relationships. So these six families, this group of six women went and they asked if they could move together. And the relationships of the six women were extraordinary. They were, you know, 22 to 28 years old. At any one time, only one had a working sink, and so that would be the one where they do the dishes. Only one had a working stove, so that would be where you'd cook. Only one had a working shower, that would be where they would shower. And they'd all share, and they'd have these social support networks. And they went to the Housing Authority and the developer and said, can you move us together? We want to live together. And that would be a violation of the Uniform Relocation Act. That would be a violation of civil rights statutes. And the Housing Authority just said, no, we can't resegregate the poor. We can't use federal money to resegregate people. But that was how they were living. They were living in these assemblages, these very tight networks. So that was one of the ways in which there was this discrepancy between how people lived and what policy could do for them. And I and others tried to come in between. There's somebody at the Urban Institute, Susan Popkin, a wonderful researcher. She's seen this side too. A lot of us tried to work in, but social policy is often so inflexible, that there has to be some marriage of top down and bottom up. That's one. The other is there are people like Ms. Bailey, whatever you think about her, there are incredible, and there are other, mostly women in this book that I've talked about, that have incredible social capital and resources that never get brought into philanthropic initiatives, that never get brought into community development initiatives. You know, no one is going to, the people in the room that form this truce among the gangs, they're never going to work for the UN and settle conflicts, but they'd be damn good at it if they ever did. So it's a vision thing. They just, you know, it's tough for us to look in communities sometimes and see strength and become aware of what exists. We know what doesn't exist.
Hi, I'm wondering about your process in writing this book, not necessarily the writing process, but your own personal process. You mentioned Steve Levitt and Dubner approaching you and asking you, saying, look, you got to really write this out. I was kind of wondering the other side, did you ever talk to JT afterward and say, look, I'm writing a book, or you ever talked to anybody else other than, you know, your publisher and your agent, even a different gang leader that said, you know, look, I know I'm using pseudonyms, I'm using alternate names, but this is kind of risky stuff. I do have an underground economy, you know, that's being kind of unreported. Was there any, you know, pre-thing that you were taking? Can you talk about it?
Yeah. Maybe I'll just, I'll end with this, and I'll say it, and I'll use a little story here. Along the way, I was trying to figure out, how do I give back to this community? And I've got to find some way. I've made a total ass out of myself. I've hurt these people, and I was just struggling. And so what I started to do was to develop a writer's workshop. Among the many things that I tried to do, one of the things that I did was to, there was a group of women who really wanted to learn how to keep a journal and were really interested in writing, or to keep a journal and interested in learning how to write. And they were single mothers. They just didn't have any time. And they were embarrassed. They felt a little embarrassed that they were doing this. So I would pick them up, and we'd go to a diner, and they would tell me these incredible stories about their experiences raising children. So much of it was about domestic abuse, just getting that off their chest, and it became a sort of a group therapy session in this diner. And I just had a chance to share my own writing with them. One day, Ms. Bailey convened this meeting with her tenant leaders, again, in a room like this, and she asked me to come sit up front. And I didn't know what it was for, and I thought, well, maybe the community is thanking me for all the great work that I've done. And she said to the tenant, she said, okay, Sudhir has kindly agreed to come here and answer questions, so please. A woman shot up, why are you taking our women every night, and what are you doing with them? And are you pimping all the women around here, and how long have you been pimping the women around? And they went on, and I thought, oh, God, what the hell is happening? And they thought that I was taking women away back to the university, because none of the women were telling them what they were doing. And so even when I was trying to do good, I ended up, you know, not always getting in the right circumstances that I wanted, or having the right outcomes. The one good thing about that process is that these women were some of the first people who read this book. And they did something that I hate them for, but I love them for, which is that they would read it out loud to me. And they said, you know, we were forced to read our experiences to you, getting beat up, having a baby, being scared, and so on. And you just sat there and took it all and did whatever you did with it. Now we're going to figure out, we're going to learn what it was like to be you. And you're going to have to sit and listen to your own voice. And it was one of the hardest things that I had to do. That was in draft form, and I had all this other stuff in there. And so that was this one part of the process that I'm really glad that I did. Again, very humbling, and sort of reversed some of that power relationship, not a lot of it, but it was very, very useful for me.
I know, with your last book off the books, what were the repercussions since you witnessed so much illegal activity, and do you predict any repercussions from this book?
I hope I don't have any repercussions from, there aren't any repercussions from this book. It's been some years now. Every once in a while, some Chicago police officer gets a little upset, and some commander wants to try and issue a subpoena and get my notes. In the most recent, I don't know, Steve Levitt and I are following a group of sex workers, and there's been a little news recently about the relationships between the sex workers and the police, and how the police contribute to the reproduction of that economy. So this is once again raising these issues. I just get a bottle of Jameson. I take this one police officer I know to this. We meet in this park, and I tell him that, you know, I have a conversation with him, and so far, everything's been fine. I haven't been subpoenaed yet. I get threatened, but I usually try. And I have a very good lawyer who I pay a lot of money to, who actually helps me, and also gets a bottle of whiskey now and then. Chicago, Illinois is, you know, I don't have the same privileges in terms of a journalist and the confidentiality in terms of journalists, like journalists do and lawyers do, in terms of being able to keep my records out of the hands of law enforcement, and even the shield laws that those folks have aren't worth much these days. But the one thing in Illinois that judges are, judges have been disposed to giving you a break if you're a researcher, if they see the social good in the activity. I think if they read this book, they may not see it social good anymore once they know how I did it, but they've been very favorable to me to date. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.